Bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. I'm Christopher and I'm your host. And joining me is back from his adventures, which I'm sure he will tell me a lot about it, but not necessarily a lot in this podcast. It's Dave McKenzie. How are you?
I'm very good. And thank you for, you know, welcoming me back. I feel like I've gone through a time warp, though, because the weather has just fallen off a cliff.
Do you know what happened yesterday?
I've gone from hot to just freezing.
Do you know what happened to me yesterday? First things, I've put the heater on for the first time this year, and I wore my puffer jacket this morning.
Look at me. We're in the studio. I've got the scarf on.
So I like the style of a puffer jacket, but it's always a bad sign. You know, it's time we pack our bags to front.
It's time to head to the Northern Hemisphere.
I know. Anyway, we have someone with us today that has ridden 11 Paris-Roubaix, a bunch of Grand Tours, 9 in total between the Vuelta and the Giro. And he's got his own podcast as well. And he's not Dave McKenzie. He's Mitch Docker. How are you?
I'm happy to be here.
What a CV. Can I just say, welcome. But
thank you.
Before you walked in, he said, how many Grand Tours has he done? And I said, I don't know. I said, how quickly are you forgotten?
I know your career,
but gee. And I was like, have you done the tour? How many? 9.
9, yes. I never got around that, but I did. My favourite was the Vuelta. See, when you, I'm always explaining this to a lot of people that you've got the two different styles of riders. Well, you used to. Before the freaks came in, they do everything. You had your classics guys and you had your tour riders, and my whole season was based around the classics.
Yeah.
Preparing for Roubaix, Flanders, you know, Wavelgem, all the races we're about to talk about, that was my Tour de France. If I didn't get a start in Roubaix, I was seriously pissed. By the time the tour came around, I was happy to kick back and watch that thing.
Yeah, okay.
Look, if they needed help out there, sure, I was up for it. It wasn't a big focus for me. The big focus at the end of the season was Vuelta. When the sun was shining, Maka, that was the best thing about
how good
it.
Is the Vuelta? I think we all done it here now.
Good.
I've been lucky enough to do the last two for SBS, but how good is the Vuelta? The vibe, everything is like, I'm not even talking about the food or anything, just the vibe around the race.
Just get rid of those climbs, those 20% climbs they like to put in, and it is the best race ever.
Fine.
Exactly. And the three-legged dogs. And
yeah.
But we're here to talk with you about, of course, the classic season. It's still on the way. There's still a lot happening, of course, but the queen of the queen of the queen is the Paris-Roubaix that's happened this weekend. First of all, the two world champions have won respectively in their category, men and women. First time in ever, pretty much in a classic as well. I think we need to check this.
Be close to it.
Absolutely.
And because, as you pointed out before we came on air,
this is the fourth edition of Paris-Roubaix.
For the women,
yeah.
There's only been so many more Flanders and so many more of the others as well. So
Mitch, how was your weekend watching Paris-Roubaix? I think that's the easiest way to start.
Well, it started out with a few cold beers, then I opened a bottle of red.
Were they Belgian? Yeah.
I had an Orval. I've got two Orvals at my house. My favourite Belgian beer, if anyone out there doesn't know, it's one of the 7 Trappists, and it's one of the only Trappists that you can age.
Okay.
And so Orvalica, as they're known over there, small beer, small Orval, you can age them. So I've got one from 2015, one from 2022, and I decided, I think it's tonight's for 2022. I'm going to save the 215 to round it out next year with a 10-year.
So the French in me, though, guys, you're talking Belgian beers.
Well, we're talking
Paris-Roubaix is France.
I know. Isn't it funny? It's a bit like
Wodonga.
It's just across the border. Come on, it's more Belgian.
It's
than
the Belgian part of France.
Roubaix is a town that deserves to be Belgian. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, that's right.
What about the racing? You talk about the freaks. The two winners, Lotte Kopecky and Mathieu Van Der Poel, freaks on freaks. That's what we can say, I think, for the performance of those riders.
I think I enjoyed watching the women's race again more than the men's.
Yeah,
happened for me a couple times like
100%.
This. It just became more exciting for me, finishing on the Velodrome with that fantastic sprint.
Flanders was the
less
same.
Control.
We'll talk about it. Flanders was the same. Flanders woman was way more exciting than Flanders men.
This is ridiculous that I'm saying this. These performances from Van Der Poel are phenomenal. And I hate that I'm saying that I'm finding it less interesting, but I sort of know the result. Let's say Roubaix, 50K to go. I was like, I don't think they're going to get him back. Do we want more? I think we just want more close races. We can't deny how good that was, though. You can't.
No. But so it's interesting. Question to you then, because I think I went through this period of when I first retired where I went, no, it's not more exciting or less exciting because, you know, Joe Bloggs wins by 3 minutes with attack 60k to go. But then the more I sit on the media side, and that happened a long time ago because I've been retired a long time. So my question to you is, 2-3 years ago, or when you first retired and first jumped straight into the media, which you did, would you be thinking the same, or have you already sort of jumped the shark and you're like, nah, it's not entertainment because he's jumped 60k to go. This isn't good for ratings. This isn't good for marketing.
Well, I think it's criminal that I'd say this, but when I wasn't racing a race, for instance, a couple of years I didn't do Flanders, and I was left out, or another year I was injured, and I got to watch Flanders as a pro still, and I was hoping it would be filthy because I wasn't there. And I mean, like, a really hard race, bad rain, everything. I'm like, you boys deserve it. I want to view something that's really hardcore. So in answer to your question,
I'm not paying to watch this. So
an easy race. I don't know. Like, it's hard to remember. I think I'm moving closer to you. I still want to see more entertainment. I want to see a really tight battle to the finish and not know the winner until, you know, at least the last sector.
Yeah, yeah.
And so just to summarize as well, on the women's side, it finished on a sprint. The sprint was very tight, and Lotte Kopecky came from way behind, pretty much where we were sitting. Remember a few years ago, we sat on that velodrome where we took our photos?
The thing with Roubaix, and I've ridden around it. I've never raced Paris-Roubaix, but I have ridden around it a couple of times in the participation ride and years prior as an amateur. It's a big track, and I grew up on velodrome racing, right? So I had track craft as a young kid. It's a big velodrome. You can totally stuff that sprint up at Roubaix, and we've
seen it. After 200 and something K.
Oh, yeah, because you see the finish line across there. It's just there. It's like I think it's a 400-meter track. That is a big velodrome, but it's a banked 400-meter, which is very rare, even in world. And you know I've got a fetish for velodromes.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you see 400-metre velodromes. You know, generally they're flat, those long ones. So it's quite deceiving. So Kopecky came from a long way back, but she actually did it with composure and smarts,
absolutely,
didn't she?
It is a super long track. And I have a question in my podcast, how long is the track of Roubaix? You know, it feels like, for me, a local track around here, a Brunswick Velodrome, 333.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 400. It's actually 500.
Whoa. Is it?
I couldn't believe it.
It's 500. Oh, I was 100 out.
I know. It's half a K.
That's why you never want it.
Really?
I know. I still can't believe it. I've got to go and measure myself. I was watching the other day Magnus Backstead win from way back in 2004. That's the thing you got to remember too. It's not a proper velodrome. It's not track racing.
Yeah.
No rules apply. Maggie comes underneath on the blue on the duck boards.
Yes. We saw that, yeah.
So you can do whatever you want there. You don't need to go hilarious up the banking because you don't have the speed. It's not a normal track. It warps people's minds. You think, oh, it's going to be a track race on here. No, it's just a normal road sprint with a bit of banking.
Absolutely.
Can I tell a really short story?
That's what you're here for, Michael. So come on.
So we're doing the Fondo, and I've got it's a little tour group, but these guys were a bunch of close mates as well. And we've finished, we've done the last sector. It's a big day. It was like 160K, so a shorter version. We come onto the velodrome. The last 2 kilometres, it starts spitting rain. And as we come on, one of the guys, and these guys are just hacks, you know, they're just weekend warriors. And he's like, oh, here we go, big sprint, you know, trying to rev each other up. So one of them goes, oh, up the bank. And I'm like, no, don't go up the bank. Anyone who's ridden a track in the wet knows you will slide straight off. So we go around the first bend. But the duckboard, it's blue, I think. It's that shiny paint. So one of the guys hits that. Woof, straight off. So he survived. He survived 15 sectors, and he crashed on the velodrome on his own.
Craziest part.
Talking about the men's race as well, there's a comment from Pedersen. I don't know if you guys saw it, but he says, Van der Poel basically played with us. He teased us all along, and then when he wanted to leave, he did it his own way, and no one was surprised because he teased us all afternoon. Is that how you saw the race as well?
I saw a really well-drilled race from the team.
Amazing. Alpecin.
You can't underestimate the speed, the covering that Vermeersch did. When you have a look at the attack from Vanderpool, it doesn't come from his wheel. He comes from three or four back, and he's got Kung in his wheel. In Vanderpool, Kung's following Vanderpool, he just gets ridden out of the wheel. And so the attack was very impressive, but the teamwork to keep that together, to set that up, the break never got away.
No.
There was good riders in the break.
They never opened up a big gap, did they?
You had Huller up there. You also had Arscreen.
Yep.
I was out there going, oh, here we go. Arscreen's going to save it for Quickstep. He's going to get into the final.
That is exactly what I thought. When Asgreen was there, I thought, this will be... Or that they might get caught, but that break will win the day with maybe Van der Poel and Pedersen will get across. But I thought, yeah.
But that's the thing. Albertsen wanted to make it hard. Yeah. They went in, they rode fast, they hit the first sector. Going into the first sector is very typically very fast as well. All those things rolled into one. By the time he attacked at 60K to go, that was, like you said, he was playing with them. The team were playing with him. They were playing into Van der Poel's strengths, being a strong guy, making the race hard. Why wait till the end when everyone sort of can have a dip? He was like, I'm just going to get everyone on their hands and knees and then put in my final stroke.
And what I find he's got, apart from everything else, right, which makes him almost unstoppable, and you'll be better about this generation after me, but he's got this like 1 minute power that is just, it's a bit like Pogacar, you know, they're slightly different, but he's got this 1 minute power effort. So when he won the Worlds in Glasgow, he had Van Aert on the wheel, attacked him on the wheel, you know, the second best guy in the world in those types of races, and rides him off the wheel. I've never seen anyone really, even in generations, where he's got this 1 minute power where he just goes whack, but then he can keep going. It's phenomenal.
And even like that's where it works in this race. Like what you're talking about there is even more incredible than, say, at Roubaix, I would say. Roubaix, because you're on the cobbles, it's very difficult to hold that slipstream. If someone's got that seated power, you know, I only experienced it when Cancellara or Boonen put the power down and I was 5-10 wheels back and just sort of getting dropped at those moments.
Oh, but Cancellara had the old engine happening too. I mean, Alex, come on.
So to experience it being on his wheel and seeing him ride the likes of, you know, Van Aert out at the Worlds on a normal road, when you get to the cobbles, no one's got a chance.
Yeah.
I wanted to touch on the chicane or chicane gate or whatever you guys want to call it, but this introduction of a chicane, which was requested by the riders or by the rider syndicate anyway, what's your take on it? Because you famously crashed at the entrance of Arenberg. I think it was on your last Roubaix. What do you make of this fact that they want to slow the riders into Arenberg? Useful, not useful? Does that, you know, remove something? Because in my own opinion, as a viewer, I'm a bit like you. I want it filthy. Mm. And Arenberg, all of a sudden, they all came in as a single line and it was less intense, at least for the viewer.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to see riders, and I'm sure they could make it in such a way where riders are crashing all over the place and make it super dangerous, but that's always been part of the race. And now suddenly it's deemed as too dangerous because the bikes are going too fast or whatever it is. We all know the risk going in there, but it is a massive element of the race. The race completely changes after Arenberg. It's before Arenberg and it's after. I was a bit sad to see that chicane come in because it just felt like a bit of a afterthought. I think there's other ways to do it.
It clearly was an afterthought. Yeah. 3 days before, 4 days
and,
before.
And, I mean, I'll just say this. I think you're more qualified to answer that because of the very nasty crash you had and you've raced it a bunch of times. So honestly, whatever you say, I'd probably agree with, or I think I should agree with, but I agree. It was a bit, I was a bit like, and when I saw the pre-video that they showed, someone did a, you know, like a GoPro vision. And I know that because I've done the Fondos and we've come from the other side on the shorter ones from the right side, if you want to call it. And I thought, this is crazy. I can't believe, but that was probably their only option at short notice, wasn't it? Because there's not too many. You can't do a square. Well, you can do a square, but it would add some serious kilometres to it. Like, there's not like a 2 kilometre square that you could do and then you turn, do a right-hand turn. They had to put that chicane in.
Yeah, yeah.
That was their only other option. So
there are some side roads there. I had a quick look after they put the chicane in and thought, oh, what's the future of this? I realised it wasn't going to happen this year. You know, maybe they need permits or whatever to get down, you know, local streets or whatever. But also you could go what happened, you know, many years ago. They used to come and enter Arenberg from the other way.
And that's slightly uphill, isn't it? Well, I mean, it's like 1%.
Exactly. And also, you've got to turn directly into it. There is no direct run into the Arenberg from the other end. So they did change that around after Museo had the big crash and, you know, broke his leg. And it only went back in the, let's say, recent years, back to this direction. So there are other ways around it. I just think that chicane sort of feels unnatural to the race.
Mm.
Let's use the natural terrain of the race to be what it is. So, I mean,
Sorry. I was just going to say, from a selfish point of view to, you know, working in media and from a fan's perspective, that aerial shot of when running is just the drama. There's not too many stages of a grand tour or one-day
races. The noise that goes with it.
The noise level and the way ASO would just zone in on that section, that sort of one-kilometre section where they go, here we go, the Arenberg, there it is. And you could see it from a long way out. Like, that shot is iconic.
But are we not just moving the I guess, the bottleneck point to a different spot, you know?
Well, the race to the chicken.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought all it is causing the crashes on that U-turn. Okay, they didn't happen. It's easy to say in hindsight afterwards, but they could have.
Yeah. I think, for me anyway, the years that I've raced it, the biggest points are on Wallers, the sector before, where there's often a crash because it's quite a hard sector. There's a couple turns in it, and we all know Arenberg is the next sector. So there's a lot of pressure into Wallers. As you go through there, often the bunch is split, as we saw this year. I'm not saying that was the reason this year, but often we're coming to, I think, gone are the days where 100 riders are coming to Arenberg.
Yeah.
Don't think it's race like that anymore. You know, where the guys are hitting, you know, the first 100 super fast, even if a break goes. Then they're hitting these sectors, the first 10 sectors, like ridiculous. But by the time they get to Wallers, it's split up. The 30, 40 guys anyway. I just think it's a little bit unnecessary now.
Yeah.
A
couple of things we haven't seen on TV as well, which make the making, I guess, of Paris-Roubaix. The police diverted farmers that were going to stop the race to protest. So that didn't happen, but police had to stop them before. And a car had the engine exploding on one of the sectors. Oil was on the ground, and you can't see the footage where they put dust on the thing to remove the oil. They brushed it like 5 minutes before the riders came in.
Wow.
So all the things
Which
you don't
car?
See.
Just the civilian car?
Yeah, civilian car, yeah. Just,
wow.
The car, the engine exploded, and there was like oil on
what
the...
What brand of car was
probably, it's probably French, my friend.
I was going to say. No, it's Belgian, but close to the border.
But that, no, they can't make cars.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's the folklore of Roubaix. How is it for you as a rider? Because none of us have done it. You've done it 11 times. How are you in the morning of Roubaix? Is there still, even after 10 times, 11 times, you still have this, you know, butterflies in the belly? How is it to ride it?
Yeah, I think it's one of those races, very easy, and you hear it all the time thrown around. You've got to love the race. You really got to love that race. And it's, you see the connection to, we mentioned Magnus Backstedt before. He only won the race only. He won the race one time. You would have thought he would have won that race 10 times. The amount that he talks about it and the amount he goes on about it. You know, Andrea Taffy, another guy who won the race once. He loves that race, and there's a lot of guys out there, me included. I didn't do anything close to that, and I'm talking about the race all the time. Something about this race, it's the journey of the race. It's the battle to get to the velodrome. You know, Cyrus Monk, he battled just to get to the velodrome. No other race are riders doing this. I've got to get to the end no matter what. I've had two punches. I've crashed. I've done whatever. Yeah. I've still got to get to the velodrome.
Fractured wrist. Yeah. I'm still going to get there.
It's an amazing draw card to get to that velodrome.
And so, how is it the entrance? When you go in, you hear the crowd. There's not a million people, but there's enough people to make noise.
It feels like a million.
Yeah.
You know, what it is, it's a sense of achievement. Because I think it's not only I've got through Roubaix, I've made it to this iconic velodrome, the crowd, everything. It's the end of the classics. It's the crescendo of a really tough period of racing. There's no race next week on Wednesday, cobble race, blah, blah, blah. So it fits. It's like the hardest, the biggest race. It's point to point as well. You're going from Paris to Roubaix. You arrive at this velodrome and the classics are over. Thank God I made it. I can go home and rest. All this rolled into one creates this beautiful part of Roubaix.
Yeah, it's just an amazing race. If you were a course designer today, you would not come in and say, let's do a race for nearly 300Ks with so many cobbles, those ancient Roman roads, and, you know, through some dust and all this. It would just be impossible today to create a race like this.
Yeah, and it's got this, obviously, you know, the historical element. Like, I think I fell more in love with Paris. I didn't race it, but I fell more in love with it.
Do you regret it?
I don't have regrets because I'll say I wasn't good enough to do it. I wasn't on the right team, but it was a focus. And, you know, it just never presented itself to me, I would have loved to have done it. But I never did Flanders either. I never got to do those big one-day Belgian classics, which really I lived in Belgium for a bunch of years, so I would have loved to have. But I fell in love with Roubaix after retirement and covering the Tour de France, the early years, and every now and then there'd be a cobbled sector.
Yeah,
so then you're doing your research. Well. You're doing your research on this, and it's like, oh, my God. This is insane how they found the Arenberg Forest, how they found this cobbled sector, and, you know, when the race came back, some of the towns were embarrassed by the state of their roads post-war, and they were like, we don't want bitumen
the roads.
they wanted to bitumen the roads. They started to do it, and then the organisers were like, no, don't.
We actually pay for you to leave them this way.
and then it went through this whole sort of evolution, and it's a beautiful story.
I saw you riding a 1960s Peugeot bike on the pavés somewhere in Roubaix.
And how good was that?
Oh, no. How good was
the
this?
The 650. We bought a on the equivalent of France eBay. We somehow discovered a 1960s grey silver Peugeot, but it was 650B wheel size. And that was our prop.
And we paid like €50 or
something. Yes. It was like we left it on the streets in
Paris. Yeah.
In Paris.
We gifted it. We actually did.
We did. Yeah, we absolutely. Gifted it to someone, which was nice.
But anyway, a quick question for you, actually. There's a big talk at the minute about safety of the riders, all those many crashes. There's even guys like Madio, we can laugh about this, but he's saying, you're safer. You're safer in a Formula One at 300k that you are on a modern bike in a racing these days. What's your take on this as an ex rider? All those crashes, the nasty crash. I mean, Vingegaard,
Basque Country.
Yep,
there's a lot.
Jay Vine, like all the stuff that we've read over the last couple of weeks. What's your take on it when you see this? Well, where are we at?
Sort of connected to this, and I just want to go back a step before I answer that completely, but go back to Roubaix and talking about these roads. There's a community called the Les Amis, this group that go out and fix the cobblestones to keep the safety of the riders. It's an amazing thing. And I didn't know this. I went back last year and did a documentary on Roubaix, and I was lucky enough to go and work with them. And
the president passed away earlier on this year, and they had this big face at the entrance of Arenberg, which sadly we didn't see much on TV, but he was there.
And that's who I was replacing the stones with. He came down, he had a big bag of croissants in the morning, and we took a stone out, a broken stone. He was explaining to me why they're doing this, because they know they love the race so much, they don't want riders to be puncturing and crashing on these sectors. It was for the safety of the riders, to preserve the stones to make the race better. So, you know, to go forward and think about what we're talking about now, we're talking about equipment changes, you know, should we reduce the gear sizes? Should we, you know, make the riders put chicanes in? And they're talking about all these crazy ideas, take Garmins off, you know, so guys aren't looking at their computers. I think there is an element of we need to look at the riders coming into the peloton. It's something I'm bang on about all the time. I feel like something that's changed a lot over the years. You know, especially from your Yamaha.
I think I know where you're going with this.
That in order for you to go pro, no one could see your power file, how fast you went up the 1:20. You know, they had to see you win a race.
They had to see your race.
They didn't care if you could do 400 watts to win the race average or 200 watts. You won the race. So you're good enough to go into our team.
So you learnt racecraft.
You learnt racecraft. So by the time
you learnt how to ride in a peloton,
by the time you got to the top end, you weren't learning how to race anymore. You were learning intricate little final details, but you knew the way a bunch worked.
Yeah.
And you knew the elements of respect of going up the ladder, the ranks. You wouldn't just ride up and cut underneath someone. What we're seeing now was what I sort of speculate is happening is a lot of guys who are super talented, deserve to be there because of their engine, need to learn how to race, and they're getting back. They're learning how to race when they're at the top end.
Mm-hmm.
You get too many of these guys mixed together.
Yeah.
We get a lot of accidents because they're not knowing how to sort of use their engine correctly.
Yeah. But then, and to go with that too, to I guess strip it all away. Yeah, sure. That was a terrible crash in the Basque Country. And because it was big names, it's obviously talked about a lot more. And, you know, crashes randomly here and there in the last few weeks. Every year there's crashes.
Yeah.
Every single year. And I guess the big talking point generally, or has been over the years, you know, Tour de France, it's getting more dangerous. It's like, I remember Bunch Kicks back watching and covering the Tour 10, 15, even 20 years ago when I was still racing, but watching it. The crashes in the bunch sprints in the first week were horrendous. And I don't think we have anywhere near the crashes that we had 20 years ago. So I think there's a little bit of that, people jumping up and down, fist pumping the table just because there's a big crash last week with, you know, the current Tour de France champ and Roglic and Jay Vine, and which isn't great, Evenepoel, who we should mention. But I don't think, you know, if you actually go back and really fine tooth comb the data of crashes over a 12-month period from 20 years ago, I actually don't think it's any worse.
Mm. I must say, you guys are exactly, so I can't contradict you.
Well, but... I don't know. I'm going off what I see, you know. So
I think there is a bit of, you know, credit in what they're saying in terms of where the technology is going, not only with the bikes, but with, I think, training and the way riders are preparing, that the bunch is going faster. We can't mm-hmm.
Well,
deny
it is,
that.
Isn't it? We've had the quickest Flanders, quickest
yep.
Roubaix, I
yep.
think.
Yep. Both yep. of them yeah. are, yep.
And it's not
having
just...
said this, there's a lot of wind as well. Wind factor on both races were a lot of wind in the back.
Yeah, true.
So
Roubaix was a strong tail, wasn't
there's
it?
There's a natural element as well yeah. to it. Yeah.
There is a natural element, but I think there, you know, it's a contribution of a lot of factors that, you know, the bikes are faster, the riders are preparing better, they're better athletes
yep.
With technology. So,
skin suits.
But does that mean we need to continually sort of put a ceiling on it? Because I think we all love to see that the top sport is the best.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. not restricted. Do yeah. we want to see restricted performance? I don't think so.
And they restrict it. They do restrict it. They make restrictions, you know, like the sock.
Yeah,
the time trial sock.
The sock on
that's
the neck,
gone.
not the height of the
bike
socks.
Weight.
Not the height of the sock, bike weight. So they are tempering it. And, you know, I think we've all been pretty critical of the UCI over the years in various things. But some credit should be given that they're not putting a ceiling on everything. They are trying to handpick elements that they feel is really changing, you know, the face or the shape of, you know, a push bike with a human being on it. And the sock for me is a bit ridiculous.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know, it works, but it looks stupid. Like so I'm actually sort of happy they've got rid of it, to be honest.
For an aesthetic
point. Yeah, exactly.
That's your European side, Maka.
Yes.
What happened with the cap? Crazy? Someone just throwing a cap in 2024. We've got a full picture of that person. It's almost not ageism or whatever. It's an old lady. Like, if, you know, we blame the teenagers, we blame the yobbies, whatever. I mean, she's not a teenager. what's going on there?
And have they caught her? Or have
I'm
they
not sure.
exposed
I'm not sure.
her?
I think they've got... They know who it is, from what I understand. And it just shows you, again, how passionate the fans are in, you know, for these races. It doesn't have to be just some, like you said, some kid or whatever it is. It's a full passionate, you know, fan. And we were talking about this before we got on air. Is, you know, that sort of rivalry, especially in the sporting world, between Holland and Belgium, almost like a hatred.
Yeah.
We've seen it in the cross season.
Mm-hmm.
Vanderpool being sort of mistreated, actually. He spat on.
And wasn't he
beer thrown in?
Big time.
He
at
was
Flanders.
Big time at Flanders. Yeah. Booed.
I really hate that side of the sport.
I must admit, I was watching Flanders on VPN, on Belgium TV, and they were the one calling it out. They were saying, this is not cool.
Yeah.
This is, you know, a respect. And they were the whole thing about, this is a respect for the riders, no matter the nationality. And they were Belgian teams.
I hope they catch this woman. I hope they expose her.
They did catch Opie Omni, remember at the time?
Yes, yeah.
At the tour, way back, they did.
Yeah.
And they made her pay a fair bit.
I mean, and that was less... that was more, you know, holding up a sign.
Yeah, it was an innocent, innocent
Yeah,
mistake.
That was an innocent one. That was just actually quite silly.
This is deliberate.
This is deliberate. Mm. She's thrown the cap. I mean, it's, as you say, it was as clear as clear.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about the crashes that we saw at the Basque Country, there's a lot of riders. You and I were talking about just before Christmas, how amazing the Tour de France is looking. All these guys are going to be there. There's going to be a top fight with probably four leaders, maybe five, and so on. I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but you said anything can happen. In one of the podcasts, I've got it on record. You said, hang on a minute, Christoph, don't stir
people
it.
Get
anything
carried
can
away.
Happen.
He's going to win. He'll finish second. Yeah. He'll finish third. They've got to make it to the start line.
Vingegaard, let's talk about Vingegaard. Double champion of the Tour de France, reigning champion of the Tour de France. He hammered Pogacar a couple of times. We'll talk about Pogacar in a sec, but Vingegaard today, the injuries that he got with a collarbone, he's got the couple of ribs, I think ribs broken, he's got a collapsed lung as well.
Yes,
so how much this is causing an issue for his campaign for the Tour de France, even if he would be fit on the start of the Tour de France in Florencia, the preparation is not going
to
be the same.
Well, I'll handball this to you as a guy who's more recent out of the peloton, but what I will say is, or what they've said, the surgery was successful. Big question mark now is the recovery time.
Yeah, well, this team doesn't do anything, you know, lightly. And if he's going to recover and get back in time for the tour, they're going to look at all avenues and see whether it's worth their while. I personally, not knowing the exact state of the injuries, you know, I don't think anyone will ever know that. It seems very tough to try and get back, you know.
It's, for July.
I think so. To defend against such a stacked, you know.
Exactly.
Pogacar, he's not some, you know, like a second B-grade rider.
Even though he's riding the Giro. But he could actually now lining up for a double.
Well, the collapsed lung for me is the big one. Only because on the history of cyclists, broken collarbone surgery, you can be on the bike in a week. You can be on a trainer.
Yeah.
Indoor, you know, keeping the fitness going. And like you say, no stone unturned with science, technology, et cetera, et cetera. But the collapsed lung, yeah, I mean...
Is it a reassessment? Is it a rejig of the team? They go the Vuelta with him. They slot a Sepp Kuss in, you know.
I was going to say, the Sepp Kuss now, all of a sudden, from being the third option last year, becomes a very interesting proposition for the Tour
and
if Vingegaard is not going.
Well, what about
Jorgensen?
Jorgensen, yeah. Sepp Kuss won a Grand Tour.
Two Americans.
Yeah.
How would you imagine that?
Oh, my God,
that?
Imagine that. And on that, Bernal, did Bernal do Basque? No, if he did, he doesn't wish harm to his rivals, but Egan Bernal, this is the best we've seen him go since he's nasty at talking about crashes, you know, a potential career-ending crash that he had, and beyond that, it was very serious on his life. It's the best we've seen him go in 2 years, which I'm just loving. I'm loving the fact that he's back challenging.
Undercover.
Yeah, he's still not at his best, but what I've noticed, he's racing a lot. They're racing him a lot. He's ready to go, and I feel like he's improving every month. You have to put Bernal back in the picture.
In that mix.
I think. I just think because of everything that's unfolding, you can't discount Egan Bernal.
And last thing, talking about the state of the union at the minute in cycling as well, and then we'll move on to Amstel as well in a sec, but Soudal. The way Soudal has transformed, a lot of talks about, you know, they were totally pretty much inexistent in this campaign of classics. Are they doing it too much for Remco? Bunen came out and talked about the team being too divided, the Wolfpack not existing anymore, and as Tom Boonen, like he's given so many trophies to the team itself, he's very angry about how the team is going, shaping again for a Grand Tour team against for Remco, which is basically creating a divide in that team. What's your take on this?
Well, something not clicking there. Clearly, are they lacking a real classics leader? You know, I think Asgreen, even though he's won Flanders, he never had those attributes, in my opinion, racing with him. He was like almost a perfect super domestique. The guy who was there to do the line, the help to the line, and then when he got his opportunity, like Flanders, he could take it. But to lead a team, you have to have that charisma, that Boonen charisma that you're speaking about, that Gilbert charisma, to just do the Alaphilippe. He's not fit for Roubaix, but like I felt like they were throwing him in the races that just don't suit him to try and go, come on, do something. We're going to use you in any possible way we
can. They want to break him mentally.
Yeah.
I'm number one defender of Alaphilippe. Okay.
So. Yeah, if you haven't realised.
So I think that's what they were lacking, in my opinion. And yes, you can divide the team and you have your tour team and your classics team, but in the classics team, you've still got to have that leader, that true beacon.
They're not going to invest in something somebody like this because it looks like they're putting all the eggs in the Evenepoel basket. They got Landa to help Evenepoel. They're building something. Landa that got injured as well, by the way. So they're building this sort of trying to do a super team against this super guy. But I don't know if it's... it's a big gamble, but would it work?
Here's the deal. I agree with both of you. However, if Evenepoel wins the tour...
Yeah, we shut up.
Well, it shuts everyone up, doesn't it? So I give him some kudos for going, you know what? We dominated the classics for 20 years.
We've done it. Yeah,
We've been there, done it. Mm. We haven't won a Grand Tour. Well, we have now because he's won the Vuelta, Evenepoel. Let's go and win the tour. And we're one of the biggest and most successful teams in pro cycling, but we've never won the Tour de France. Let's go and do it. So I sort of like it. I like it that they are compromising. Oh, you know, that they are putting all the eggs.
Especially coming back after the whole Jumbo merger. Is it going to merge? Is it not going to merge?
Yeah.
They're coming out with a bit of
bizarre.
An identity.
That whole thing is still bizarre.
Just, I think it's just hard for them when it's in their own backyard.
Yeah.
You know? Even if that is the grand plan, they've still got to cop all this media in their own backyard.
The Belgian press and sponsors. Oh,
they've got to brunt this until, hopefully, the plan comes through, if that is the plan.
First time ever, Patrick Lefebvre wasn't at Roubaix. First time ever.
Really?
Yep, he wasn't here.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Have you got one of those Apple chip things?
I've got my insiders, and I'm telling you, first time ever, Patrick wasn't at Roubaix.
Hey, can I just finish? Are we just about off the Roubaix and all that talk? I do just want to say one little clip, because I think it's really worth mentioning. The first Chinese cyclist to finish Paris-Roubaix was Jin Tang. She finished in 99th place.
Okay.
But what is more amazing is that it's the first Chinese athlete. Talking about the globalization of the sport, China cycling is still untapped. And they've been around. They've been dabbling.
You've raced there.
I've raced there a lot. Yeah. You've raced with some Chinese cyclists on your team.
I have, in Skill Shimano.
They did the Tour de France,
They did the Tour,
Yeah. And I just think it's still so untapped. And I was just reading the article. It was a really nice article. Two Chinese women started for really small, one of the smallest budget teams. One finished, one didn't. But, I thought that was
There's also
cool.
a nice story about the youngest rider in Roubaix didn't make the time cut but still wanted to finish and went and did the lap of the velodrome. And Guy, I think.
Oh, wow.
And they allowed him to finish.
To finish
and think, but even though he was outside of the time cut.
That's
cool. So that's also what the race is all about.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Amstel is happening also this week. How is it to move from a Paris-Roubaix/Amstel as a race as well in the middle of the week? What's the switch? Is there a switch? Like,
it's a very hard thing to do, and I've only done it once, and I didn't like it. The problem is you're up there in Belgium and, France, as you like to call it.
Yeah. Officially it is.
doing these cobblestone races with more or less the same riders for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, and you get your spot in the peloton. All of a sudden you go to Amstel. It's a different terrain, but it's also you get half the peloton of these Ardenna climbers coming in. And you sort of a bit old and tired and grumpy and, I've done Roubaix last week and you've got your spot. And these young guys, fresh, this is the start of their classics. Here we go. We're going to do this. So it's this clash of the two mixes of the classics. Once you get to, Liège and Flèche, I think all the cobblestone riders are out of it, except for one or two, maybe. So it's a different thing. But this Amstel is the mix.
Mm.
I wouldn't say half and
because
half.
Because it's a little bit closer. Mm. I suppose it's closest to Flanders, I suppose. Is that a fair
comment? It is. It is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it is about positioning.
Yeah.
The climbs are much harder.
Yeah.
But you can, if you're very good at positioning, which I think the cobblestone riders are better than the climbers, you can start and you can get through the race a lot further by just knowing the roads. Being in a good position at the start of the climb, the roads are very tiny in Holland around that area, very similar to Flanders.
Yep.
And you get halfway up the climb and you can drift back and the next thing you get to the next climb, I'll just get to the front again and do the same thing on repeat. Whereas the climbers who can't get as good a position use the climb to move up.
Mm.
And that's sort of how you can get through it. Once you get to Liège, climbs are too long, too hard, you're just going to get dropped.
Mm. Okay. Good reading on it.
Oh, yeah. It's
any tip for who's going to be serious at that race? Because, we still yet to know what's the start list, but there's some obvious riders that will be there. Who would be your pick?
Well, I think, looking at Alaphilippe, he wants to show something there now. It's coming to his kind of racing. Better suited than, say, the cobblestone races. But how much has that taken out of him? How much of the pressure of the team has taken out of him coming to these races? I'm really interested to see what happens there with Soudal, Quickstep. Maka?
Yeah. One to watch.
Look, I think it's such an open... I think it's the way you just said it, it's that classic clash of the leftovers from the flatter, cobbled classics into the Ardennes. Alaphilippe, he's not the rider that he was 5 years ago. He's not the rider that he was 3 years ago, but he can still win. He can still win. And maybe he's the guy that saves the classics for them.
And I love, as a viewer now, I love seeing guys, old friends, sort of come back into the mix, like a good old favourite, Mike Woods. He's, you know, this is his time of year to come back in, very good at Liège, very good at Flèche. And Amstel was that race he was sort of just trying to get involved with again. It's where you see the crossover. Michael Matthews will be floating around again. So that's that different crossover. That's what I do like about Amstel. It's not, I wouldn't say Liège is predictable, but you get this different mix of riders. You get, you know, your Woodsies versus your Matthews, as sort of a sprinter who can climb, versus your punchy climber.
Well, Matthews, he could totally win it, couldn't he?
He's been up there.
He's been allegedly twice on the podium.
Yeah. I mean,
even though he was DQ'd, I must say.
And then just to throw a couple of smokies out there, and this is possibly real smoky, don't know how he's going, Mark Hirschi. Someone like that.
Yeah, he was going great, and I think he had to pull out of a couple of races, but he was the first part of the year, he was going really good.
Bob Youngles? Is Youngles up for something like that?
Yeah, for sure. He's definitely moving a bit more into, you know, Youngles is one of those riders who's been able to do a bit of both.
Yeah.
But in the recent years, he's really sort of pushed a bit more to sort of being in the support in the tours.
I'll go with Alaphilippe.
Okay, good.
So thank you, Mitch, for popping in. It's always good to have your vision. I remember you, because you're wearing the cap, you've got your own podcast as well, so you know the game, you know how it works.
Well, it's a beautiful studio here. I wouldn't mind one of these around my joint.
You can merge your podcast with ours. You
know? Yeah. Bring your sponsors over too. Well, at the same time.
It's always welcome around here. Thank you, Mitch. Thank you, Maka. It's awesome to have you back.
Good to be back.
Have a pint and talk about your trip in Vietnam off the record.
Yeah, off the record. Definitely. Yeah, no, good to be back. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. It was the SBS Cycling Podcast. We'll see you next week.